I bow to all high and holy lamas.
Pabongka Rinpoche
took that as a cue to comment upon and to give a teaching on exactly what is a lama and how to take, how to rely on a lama. I'm sure you've come up and there was a lot of confusion about exactly what is a lama. Some people think a lama is just someone who has reached some high rank and then they give him the title lama. When you go to Nepal, anybody who wears a robe, they call a lama. And of course, there's an animal called lama. They should not be confused with that one at all. And there are different grades of lama. Lama simply means, I mean, not the exact translation of the word, but it means a teacher. Okay. Anyone who teaches is a lama. Okay. And why do we say, why don't we just say teacher? Why do we use that foreign term, lama? I think probably earlier in the, I don't know, maybe in the 60s, in the flower power days, the term we used to use was guru, instead of just using the word teacher. And lama is actually the exact translation of the word guru. La, by itself means something which is high. Okay. And ma is the negation. So it doesn't mean not high, it means higher than that, you cannot find something else. That's what it means. So the lama is the one that you can rely on, the ultimate object that you can rely on. Okay. And coming from a Western perspective, coming from Western background, when you first encounter these teachings on lama, which is very important in Buddhism and very important in Asia, actually. Not just in Buddhism in general. In Hinduism, it's very important. In Taoism, it's very important. The lama is a very important object. And it goes even into both the Hindu understanding of guru. Is that understanding is carried throughout all the philosophies in the East, whether it is in China, whether it is in Japan, or anywhere else in Asia. And that understanding is the guru is God in your life. Okay. So if you're someone who is desperate to meet with God, once you found a guru, you consider that you have found God. Okay. And in some ways, it is even said that the guru is even more important than God. Okay. And the same ideas are taken also into Buddhism. That the guru, the teacher, the lama, is more important, is as important as the Buddha, or even more important than the Buddha. Okay. And why? Okay. The example that I would like, that I use at times is someone who is interested in becoming a carpenter, or someone who's interested in becoming a doctor. And it seems to be a very logical thing for you to do. If you want to be a doctor, you don't go to a carpenter to learn how to be a doctor, right? And if you found someone who's teaching you and from whom you're gaining knowledge about how to become a doctor, you would naturally say to yourself, this must be a doctor. Otherwise, he wouldn't be teaching me how to become a doctor. But when you come to the spiritual arena, it's kind of difficult to see the qualifications. Whether or not this person is actually qualified, or better, whether or not this person is the objective, the embodiment of the objective that I'm looking for. Is this person the Buddha? Is this person a Buddha? And it gets into a lot of mystical fog when it gets to trying to really pinpoint this idea. This is the Lam Rim. The Lam Rim is not something that is unique only to Gelugpas. It was brought to Tibet, the idea of Lam Rim, like graded path, as it is, was something that was coined by Lord Atisha. And he brought it to Tibet way before the Gelugpas were around. So this genre of teaching called Lam Rim started way back then, And you can even consider that it goes back even to the Buddha. It has to go back to the Buddha, right? If it doesn't go back to the Buddha, it's not authentic. You should question it. When you read any sutra that is quite in depth, that sutra itself, even the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, is itself a lambrim. It takes you from very quickly how to become a bodhisattva, and then what are you supposed to do as a bodhisattva, and then what is the goal that you reach when you fulfill your vows as a bodhisattva. So it's like a lambrim. It is a lambrim. Now, within the Tibetan tradition, there are 14 or 15, depending on which lambrim you're studying, there are these realizations along the path that you're supposed to achieve. And they're all based upon each other. Within the Gelugpa system, the very first realization that you're asked to gain is a realization of that the Lama and the Buddha are the same. You're supposed to equate the Lama with Buddha. And don't think that you're the only one who has problem accepting this. Even the Tibetans have problem accepting this. And if you just buy it outright just because it is written, then maybe you're not really understanding what it means. So what does it mean that the Lama is the Buddha? Okay. And when you read the Lamrim, whether it is the Gelugpa Lamrim, where it begins with the how to properly rely on a teacher, and the other Lamrims, the Lamrims of the other schools in Tibet, they don't begin with proper reliance on a teacher. They begin with the life, how fortunate you are to be a human being. So you discover that how fortunate you are to be a human being and how you should make the best of it, and to make the best of it, go find a teacher. So that's how they present it. And it was actually Jason Kappa who put the emphasis on the Lama at the very beginning of Lamrim. Because Jason Kappa said, well, since everything depends on the Lama anyway, so we might as well start right there. And Pabongka Rinpoche, out of compassion for us, in a very small work that he did for one of his disciples, exactly how to practically practice the stages of the path. And he said, of course, you have to begin with proper reliance on a teacher. But he said that, don't worry, that's one of the hardest realizations to gain, for you to say to yourself, my teacher is the Buddha. For you to come to that conclusion where you're not just saying it just because you were told to say it, because you're not saying it just because you're afraid of not saying it. You think that if you don't say it, then you know you're going to go to hell, because I mean, it says so somewhere, right? So what is the Lama? And when do you begin the relationship of Lama and teacher and student? And what qualifies someone for you to call them Lama? One of the things to address is, probably you've heard it already, that if you do not consider someone a Lama, someone who has taught you as much as a lion, then you will go to the hells and burn for as many eons as there are grains of sand in the ocean or something like that. Now that's a very scary relationship to get involved with. Okay. And some people are even afraid of listening to people say, if you're going to teach you Dharma, wait, I don't want to hear it, because I don't want later on, you know, find out that you're not the person who's supposed to be rely upon, and I'm supposed to rely upon you, and then I'm stuck with you forever, and no matter what you do, I'm supposed to take it for granted. Okay? That's the word of the Buddha. Now, the thing is, once you examine the person, and then you conclude to yourself, I will take this person as my Lama, what you're actually saying is, this is what you're actually doing. What you're actually doing is, looking at this heap, looking at this collection of body and mind, I perceive for myself the proper basis for me to put the label Lama. Okay. And once you've done that, and then you go to the person and you say, okay, be my Lama, because I've examined you, and it seems to me that through you the Buddhas are talking to them. Okay, when you say something, it has very deep meaning for me. When you do something, it has deep meaning for me. Even when you get on my nerves, it has deep meaning for me. Okay. And once you've established that relationship, once you've gone to that person and you've done that, and you said that outright, and the person and also say, well, I've been looking at you, and I won't mind being your teacher. So that's now a contract. It is sealed. Now you are now teacher-student. You have that relationship. Once you have that established that relationship, even if they teach you only one line and the person disappears from your life, you have to consider that person lama. That's what this is saying. It doesn't mean that you go, nowadays, you hear so-and-so famous teacher is teaching on this very, very famous high practice, and you go and listen to them, and they teach more than one line, they teach a whole book, right? So are you stuck with that person forever? Is that person supposed to be your lama forever? No, that's not what it's saying. Okay, that's not what he's saying. It's once you have established that relationship, it's not a one-way relationship, it's a two-way relationship. Okay. And once it is established, then even if they only teach you one line and you never see them again, that person is lama. And towards that person, you must always, when you do your meditation on lama, when you do the meditation on trying to equate lama with Buddha, you're supposed to try to equate that person with Buddha. And that's something else that we're going to get into, okay? When I first got this teaching on the Lam Rim and of course about the teacher being the Lama, I didn't have much of a problem, because the person who was teaching it to me, already demonstrated to me, and I saw this person is definitely, can lead me to my goal, to Buddhahood. And I'm not going to say that I, from the very beginning, say that this person is a Buddha, but I had great faith in this person. But I'm thinking now, what about when I start teaching? I'm sure that I'm not going to start teaching. I practice, I become a Buddha, and then I start teaching. And then people will, can decide whether or not I'm a Buddha. But once they decide I'm a Buddha, they are right. But if they don't decide I'm a Buddha, then they're wrong. If they say I'm not a Buddha, then they're wrong. But I'm going to start teaching anyway. Actually, I refused to teach for a very long time because of that. I had a lot of problem with that. And then it was Geshe Michael Roach himself who was sort of encouraging me. you gotta teach. And then he even tricked me. I'm going out of town, and this is the fifth class, and I didn't have chance to announce it, and the people are coming, so I need someone to be there, and you're the only one I can rely on. So then started my too early career in teaching. Okay. And I said to myself, I'm not a Buddha. If someone comes to me, if someone somehow is inspired because of the Dharma and because it's coming from me, and they start related, they're gonna when they say the Lama is Buddha, it's not gonna be true. So what does it mean really when you say the Lama is Buddha? Does the basis, as far as from the perspective of the owner of the basis, does it have to be true? Is Ken Rinpoche, Losang Tachin, my Lama, is he to himself a Buddha? And all the other ones, the Dalai Lama, the Pabongka Rinpoche, all those great teachers, Kyabje Tijon Rinpoche, whoever, are they to their own selves, in their own mind, are they going around knowing that I'm a Buddha and they're waiting for someone to recognize them? Well, the Dalai Lama and those other people are sort of, difficult because they're supposed to be emanations. So. But someone like Ken Rinpoche, who hasn't made any claim to be the emanation of anybody, is he in his own mind a Buddha? And is that I should wait for that for me to make that claim, Lama is Buddha, my Lama is Buddha. Well, we digress a little bit before I answer that question. Okay. Remember, you want to be a doctor. You want to cure people, right? You don't go to a carpenter to teach you how to become a doctor, teach you how to heal people. You go to a doctor. Or you go to someone who knows medicine quite well, right? So that logic is, you know, you're not going to debate me and try and ask me to defend it, right? It's acceptable, right? So you want to become a Buddha. You want to help all sentient beings. So who else can help you become a Buddha other than the Buddha? And in what way does the Buddha manifest as your teacher? Does he send an actual emanation? By actual emanation, I mean take birth, and then he appears in your life and then waits for you to recognize him as a Buddha, and then so you start the relationship? Or is it something else? Something even not so mysterious, not so mystical? And this goal that you're seeking, which is called Buddhahood, there's something about the training, about the mindset that you're supposed to have as you are training, that will help you get there faster, or will even slow you down. But to give an actual example, one of the direct disciples of the Buddha, and this might even confuse you even a little bit more, actually, but I'll tell it to you anyway. One of the direct disciples of the Buddha left the Buddha because he didn't think that the Buddha was Buddha. And he considered the Buddha to be just someone who, just a nice guy who happens to have, you know, nice halo around him. Okay. He shines, just a nice guy who shines. And he considered someone else to be someone who has achieved Buddhahood, Arhathood. And that person was, to him, was displaying what he thought was supposed to be what a Buddha was supposed to be displaying. At the time of the Buddha, there were a lot of people who were claiming to be Buddhas, a lot of people claiming to have real, be enlightened. And it was considered that, some thought that in order for you to become a Buddha, you have to go through this very hard asceticism. And only after this, doing this hard asceticism, would you actually reach the state of Arhathood, the state of Buddhahood. And there was one particular practice where you're supposed to make yourself like, it's like, you know, taking one of the eight verses in the one of the lines, one of the verses in the eight verses of mind training, and take it to its, you know, like literal, take it literally, the part about be the lowest. So one of the practices of being the lowest was, what's the lowest among us is a dog. So the practice was to behave, take on the behavior of a dog. Take on the behavior of a dog and you will reach Arhathood. Okay. So walk on all fours, don't eat from a plate, walk around naked, don't talk to certain people, don't answer when you ask a question and things like that. So it was, and there was an actual a group of people who actually believed in this practice and they were practicing it. And I guess this disciple of the Buddha thought that these were very highly advanced spiritual people. Okay? And there was one particular, they were called the dog ascetic. There was one dog ascetic in the neighborhood whom the disciple of the Buddha happened to revere. And he thought he was an arhat. While you didn't think that the Buddha was enlightened. Now he went to the Buddha one day and then he to complain. I'm leaving you. And the Buddha said, asked, why are you leaving? He said, well, I mean, you never show any miracles. You never display miracles. So I'm leaving you. And the Buddha continued. Most of you know this story already? Should I continue? So the Buddha said, Did I meet you somewhere and I said, come follow me and I'll show you some miracles? They say, no. And then the Buddha said, do you remember that time when that happened and there was a display of miracles and I'm the one who did it? So yeah. But it's almost as if, you know, you didn't make any miracles especially for me kind of thing. So the Buddha said, I didn't invite you. The Buddha can be very mean sometimes in terms of direct, right? did I invite you to come join me? And did I promise you that if you join me, I'll make miracles for you? And he said, I didn't invite you, so you are free to come, so you're free to go. So he left. So he went to join this, to become the disciple of this dog ascetic because he considered him to be highly enlightened. And one day the Buddha passed by him, and then the Buddha said, he will die in 7 days. He will die of indigestion. So he went to the dog ascetic, the disciple, well, the ex-disciple of the Buddha, to say, oh, the Buddha said you will die in 7 days from indigestion, so don't eat anything. So to prove that the Buddha is not really enlightened. And of course, on an exact day, exact time the Buddha predicted he will die, he died. And then he went to the Buddha and he said, okay, yeah, the Buddha, he died of indigestion. But he believed that he went to some high, he must have gone to some high rebirth or something because of his, you know, extreme asceticism. And the Buddha said, no, he wasn't born as some high deva. As a matter of fact, he's born as a very low grade. How can you prove this to me? Say, okay, I'll teach you this. So the Buddha said to him, kick him on the day of his cremation, and then I will do some miracles, and he will be able to come alive and tell you where he is born. And then on that day, when he was being cremated, he went and kicked him, and then he asked him, and he told him. And he found out he wasn't a high rebirth. Now, why am I telling you this story? It has to do with Lama, right? And recognizing the Lama as the Buddha. Now, and I say this might confuse you, because according to this disciple, according to his perception, the dog ascetic was Buddha. And was the dog ascetic Buddha? No. So if he received teachings from this dog ascetic, would he have reached Buddhahood? He would have reached whatever the dog ascetic reached, right? Which is a very low grade birth. But he thought him to be a Buddha. So the important thing, lesson here is not just you don't just throw the label on just anybody who you want to, and that doesn't make them be for you a Buddha, just because you put the label on them Buddha. Okay, so that's why there is this list of qualifications. The Buddha himself listed some of the qualifications in not like in one list in one sutra, but in various sutras. And in one sutra, in one book by Asanga called The Ornament of Sutras, he listed what are the qualifications. He listed 10 qualifications for what is a qualification for a proper basis that you can put the label Buddha. Okay? So you observe this group of heaps, this body, this mind, and then you observe it and you see if you see any of those 10 qualifications. And if you see any of those 10 qualifications, then that basis become a proper basis for you to put the label Lama. And after you put the label Lama on it, then it can act for you as Buddha. The list depends, of course, on how are you going to depend on this on this Lama. If you're going to depend on this Lama only in the sutra path, there's a particular list of requirements, list of things to perceive. If you're going to depend on this Lama in terms of Tantra, then there's also an additional number of lists, a number of items in the list. Even in the sutra, if all you want is a Lama to teach you the path to Nirvana, which is Hinayana, then the list is even shorter, okay? But the list that the Asanga assembled can be applied to anyone, okay? whether they're in Sutra Lama, whether they're the Tantra Lama. Okay? And you can add to this list. You can add to this list. So the path to Buddhahood requires that you yourself have an exceptional control over your mind, an exceptional control over your behavior. And it requires that you master a certain body of knowledge. Okay. So since the path requires that, and you need to do this, so you need someone to teach you how to do this. And this person who's going to teach you how to do this must be someone who actually is either more advanced, who knows more about these things than you, or has actually completely mastered them. Okay. Like, for example, in the Vinaya system, someone who is qualified to be a Vinaya master, that is, by Vinaya master, that means someone who's qualified to give vows, to give the transmission of the Vinaya, must be someone who is steady in their vows, and also who has a particular knowledge or particular understanding of the Vinaya. That is, they've memorized quite a number of the scripture of the Vinaya. At least they've memorized the vows, right? What the vows are. And they have some memories, some committed to memory, at least the root commentaries on the vows. And they are able to recite the Pratimoksha Sutra, which is the root sutra on the vows. They're able to recite it, and they're able to give explanation upon it. And when they're reciting the sutra, they don't mix it up. Like, they don't begin with the first line, and then somewhere along in there they go into the last line, and they go back again into the middle line. Like, they don't mix it up. Okay. So someone who has this kind of a understanding, this kind of a knowledge, is considered to be qualified to transmit Vinaya. Okay. Steady, and by steady, they mean someone who at least kept their vows, their full ordination vows, for at least 10 years. That means the monk is the steady. Okay. That. If sometimes steadiness can refer to a monk who is after 5 years of keeping their vows, but within 5 years they've already mastered most of the Vinaya. So that's an exceptional person. Okay. But at least, on the average, have kept their vows for 10 years without making any major breaking, and they've mastered some elements of the Vinaya. Okay. So if someone is like that, then you can rely upon them. And of course, there is in the same way here, in order for you to gain control of your mind, you need to practice meditation. You need to practice concentration. In order for you to have gained a good mastery of concentration, you need to watch your being. You need to master mindfulness. And mindfulness is basically being mindful of the commitments that you made, being mindful of your ethics. And that's the very first qualification. The first qualification is that the person that you are going to depend upon as a teacher is someone who's ethical. Okay. And someone who has a great mastery, a great control in their behavior, in their body, in their verbal behavior, in their mental behavior. I mean, you may not see the mental behavior, but you may see signs of it. Okay. That they have gained quite profound control of their three doors. Having gained control of the three doors means that the person is ethical. They don't say the wrong thing. They don't abuse people with their words. They don't think evil things. And so, and in the scriptures, when the Buddha is talking about that, he said one of the qualities of the Buddha is that the Buddha is someone who doesn't think evil thoughts. Okay. And how does someone know someone is thinking evil thoughts? It's not that you read their minds directly, but in their actions, you can deduce that, oh, that comes from an evil thinking, that kind of thing, okay? So that's the first qualification, duruwa, which is Tibetan for ethics. It means tamed, okay? The word itself means tamed. So they've tamed their mind, or they've tamed their behavior, rather. And ethics for such a person is not a burden. Okay. Unfortunately for us, because of our, I don't know, because of rebellion that we've had with our society, and especially because of, probably because of remnants of the puritanical kind of behavior that we somehow inherited in this society, the Victorian, is it right? When you hear ethics, it's more like someone's finger pointing, rather than you yourself, according to your own character, to your own judgment, acting and behaving properly, rather than some finger pointing at you, telling you, don't do this, don't do that. And the way Calvinism, any Calvinists here? And the reason I'm using that example is because of a dear friend of mine who's a Calvinist, who doesn't talk about Calvinism in any good light. Okay. And what he remembers is that from the first moment that he goes to church, is that, you know, you're bad, you're bad, you're bad, you're bad, you're bad. And if you try to enjoy yourself, oh, you're worse, you're worse, you're worse. Okay? So somehow associate ethics with stop enjoying yourself. Okay? And it's not just a Western thing. I mean, go back to the time of the Buddha where these people were behaving like dogs. It was like, it was almost the same thing. If you're going around life, enjoying yourself, like it's Tibetan lamas, you know, they're always laughing. What's wrong with them? Okay. There's something wrong with you. You're unethical. You're supposed to be stern, serious. You're supposed to be in pain. And you're supposed to be enjoying it. And you're not supposed to show that you're enjoying it. That means you're ethical. Okay. Ethics mean avoid the good things in life. And we have this idea in the back of our mind when we hear the word ethics. And when we hear someone talk about ethics, we sort of cringe, we don't really want to hear it, but we have to hear it because, you know, you're told we better hear it. But and we rebel, and we have some sort of rebellion. We hear it, but we don't really hear it. Okay. So think of ethics as skillful behavior. Okay, skillful behavior. That's what ethics is about. You want this? What is a skillful way? What is a skillful behavior that will really get it, really get you to meet with that? Okay? That behavior, whatever it is, the thing you have to say, the action you have to do, what you have to think, that thing that really, that behavior that really, really now, okay? Not deceptively, but that really got you to get what you want. That is, you know, we all want happiness, right? In some degree, in some manifestation. That behavior that you got you to that, really got you to that, that is called ethics. Okay. And whatever it is that you may have done that took you away from it, and you ended up being miserable, you ended up with being in pain, experiencing problems, those sets of behaviors, those sets of activities, those are unskillful. Those are unethical. Okay. So ethic has to do with pleasure. It has to do with seeking pleasure properly. The proper behavior that gets you to pleasure. Okay? It has nothing to do with you must stop eating ice cream because you like it, because since you like it, it's unethical. Okay? So when you are someone who has an understanding of the skillful actions that leads to gaining what you really want, which is bonheur. Happiness. Is that it? Just it? No, it seems to be more than that for some reason. You know, happiness? Okay, what? Happiness. No, the philosophical way of treating happiness, okay? Those sets of behavior, when you have an understanding that these behavior, these activities, speaking this way, thinking this way, acting this way with my body, this will lead to happiness. And then you know that these behavior, this speaking this way, thinking this way, acting this way, this will lead me away from happiness. Then you stay away from those behavior. And unfortunately, since we are samsaric beings, we are adept at what? We are adept at getting in trouble. So it's habitual for us to behave in those ways that brings us pain, that brings us problem, that brings us the things that we don't want to have. being forced to meet situations that you wish that you didn't meet, being taken away from the situation that you are enjoying. Okay. Now, how did we get stuck into, how did it become a habit, right? I mean, as a child, you touch fire, it burns, you learn, and that automatically from then on, you don't touch fire anymore. You don't get into a habit of always removing your finger from fire. Well, a very devious thing happened, or is happening. That's how we develop the habit of unskillful deeds. The seed from an action that we ripen as pleasure ripens at the wrong time. And we form the misconception that, oh, this action gives pleasure. And because we have, you know, seemingly direct experience of the result of an action, we think we are experiencing the direct result of an action, and it stimulates us to, what's that in psychology? Pavlov, right? Dog asceticism, right? So we experience pleasure, we think it's coming from the action, the immediate action we just implemented, and then it gives us a sort of response, like pleasure response, oh, we should do this to get pleasure. Okay? It reinforces that in our mind, the concept that we must do this again. Okay? So we fall into the habit of doing unskillful deeds, right? Now, how do we finally end up knowing that it doesn't bring happiness? Because we are still looking for happiness. And how many actions have you committed already? Numberless, you cannot count them. As soon as you came out, even when you were in the womb, you were acting in ways so you can get pleasure. You came out of the womb, you started to act to get pleasure. One of the things that you learn to do so you can get pleasure, right? You need your mother's milk. What do? You cry. it gives me milk. So crying is a direct cause for getting milk. So you keep crying when you want something. But when you grow older and you cry, you don't get milk. You get the opposite, maybe, okay? And they want you to shut up. Okay. But because we already established the pattern within our mind, crying is supposed to bring milk, so we think that we are not crying properly, okay? We have to adjust the crying because we know we got milk from it. It was evident to us. We cried. And, you know, this big lady ran toward us, carried us, and then fed us, and we were happy. So there's something wrong with the way we are crying right now. That's why we're not getting the milk anymore. Okay. So it's not that the reason that we are caught in this cycle of constantly engaging in unskillful action, it's not that, you know, all beings are sadomasochists by nature, you know. What's your ultimate nature? Sadomasochist. Okay? If you go into deep meditation and one day you discover you have a direct perception, we are sadomasochists. Okay? Okay. No, I'm kidding, right? Okay. It's not that that's our true nature and we just, you know, we just love and pain. That's why we keep doing these unskillful actions. Okay? It's because we are convinced at the core of our being that this action will give us pleasure, will give us happiness, philosophical happiness. We don't yell at someone because we think that, oh, that'll be a good 5 years in you know, burning in hell. Let me do that. Okay? No, it's because we think that it's a direct cause for happiness. And the deviousness of psychic existence is that right after you yell at someone, maybe the seed for good karma ripens and you experience some pleasure. And you think that yelling at people is what causes pleasure. You know, when someone gets on your nerve, You hit at them real nicely. You give you choose the nicest word that you can think about, and you say it, and they're hurt, and you feel a bit of satisfaction, and you think that, yeah. When you choose the proper word and you yell correctly at someone and acting out of anger, it gives rise to. That's what the cause of displeasure is. Okay. And you keep yelling, and you develop a high blood pressure later on, and you think it's because you're not yelling properly. Maybe you're yelling too loud, or maybe the decibels is wrong or something. That's why now you're getting high blood pressure. Because you know from experience that when you first yell at someone, you get a little sense of pleasure. Okay. So once you start to disassociate yourself from this warped way of thinking that, you know, what you experience after a particular event is not necessarily the direct result of that event. Once you start knowing that to be the case, then you start to evaluate your life, start to reevaluate your behavior, and it should be a very simple thing. Okay? For example, let's make it global, okay? Like global things. War. How long have human beings been engaged in war? As a matter of fact, I think somebody made some sort of a statistics. Maybe, for the past thousands and thousands of years, maybe on the planet where there was no war whatsoever, maybe it was one day or something like that. But why do we go into war? You don't go into war because you think, let's do some chaos and maybe at least countless eons in the hot hells, you know, let's do it. It's because the one who is the aggressor believes that this will benefit us. This will give us happiness. You know, crush your neighbor, take away their resources, and we will be happy. And it seems like we have amnesia or something, or no one has taken, as recorded these things. We've been doing war for, I don't know how long, as long as there's this thing called civilization. And so far, there's not one country that says, we are happy. And yet, we keep doing it. Because we keep thinking, it will make us happy. We just didn't do the war the way we're supposed to do it. Okay. We didn't have, what you call that, surgical bombing. We didn't have carpet bombing. Okay. That's why the nation didn't reach happiness yet. We didn't have the right weapon. Okay. So, on a personal level, you're suffering, and you understand that your suffering is not someone outside of you who's responsible for your condition, because if someone else is responsible for your condition, you are doomed. You will never see happiness. Okay. So, since someone else is not entirely responsible for your situation, and you take personal responsibility for it, and it seems reasonable, at least in the beginning, you don't have direct understanding of it yet, but it seems reasonable. At least, it's a line of reason that goes against, here I am suffering, I am acting, and you know that in order for you to have results, you must place the cause. It's a natural thing that you don't have to go to school to learn. Okay? Remember when you're a baby? I want the result milk. I have to do an action. I have to instigate the cause. Maybe you are wrong as to exactly what's the actual cause of real milk, but you know, you cried and you got milk, and you think that was the true cause of getting milk. Okay? But it was from a non-intellectual, when you were a baby, you didn't go to a PhD college, you know, you got a PhD so you could learn what you need to do, that you have to, in order for you to get the results you want, you have to put a cause. Okay, that's instinctive, right? So you have that already, so you know that to get a result, what result? Happiness, you have to put the cause. You have to, I don't want to use the word generate, you have to stimulate the cause, okay? And you know that you are experiencing things already. You're experiencing your life already. That means you are getting results already. So if you're getting results already, that means you've acted already. Now, all you have to do is just look at your natural way in which you act and do the opposite. Okay? You're getting results. They're not the results you want. You must have acted already in a natural way. So now what you have to do? Stop acting those ways. Stop acting in those natural ways which bring about naturally pain. So you don't need to go to the sutras to read what are the list of the things that I should mustn't do. Just look at, okay, I'm suffering, I'm experiencing suffering, these are results. I acted and that's why I'm experiencing these. So therefore, the natural compulsion to act a certain way, I must question it. Someone makes me angry, and I think, and the natural compulsion, you want to be happy, you want to stop this feeling, stop this feeling of anger which is making you unhappy. You want to be happy now? Get angry back, yell at them, and then you yell back. So since you're already adept at yelling at people, and you're still unhappy, maybe yelling back is not the cause for happiness. Okay, so you start putting this in the list. The list of things to avoid doing, and the list of things to do. And this list, when you follow this list, and then you start getting happier and happier and happier, then you are ethical. That means you are now skillful. You're skillful in your actions. Okay? Ethic has nothing to do with punishing yourself, stop enjoying yourself. It has nothing to do with you must do it because it is said. Okay, it's just skillful action that brings about true happiness. And the teacher is someone, it seems like we left that away a long time ago, right? And the Lama is someone who's well tamed, someone who's been putting this thing into practice. That's why when you go to someone, actually in both the sutra and the tantras, when the Buddha is talking about how to find a proper teacher, one of them is, they don't list it here, is someone who is joyful. Okay. That's a sign for you that they are ethical. Okay. Because they are applying skillful means and they're getting the real result of it. Okay. That should be a sign for you. So if you go to someone who's been practicing for 40 years and they are a wreck, the sign of being a wreck doesn't necessarily mean, you know, doesn't mean that they're not advanced. Like, you know, there are some bodhisattvas who are a wreck because they are depressed about your situation. You know, you heard the bodhisattvas ever weeping, and there was this bodhisattva very recently, a book was written from his poetry was published. I forgot his name, very bad of me. He was always sad. And his sadness was because bodhicitta was in his mind all the time. He was sad about the condition of beings. So, taking those exceptions aside, if the person, has, after 40 years, 50 years, and they're still miserable, then that should be a sign for you to know. You should check out. You should, maybe I should examine you a bit further. Okay? Are you a wreck because of your deep compassion for sentient beings, or because, you know, you're just a wreck? So that's the first one, durwa, tamed. They've tamed the three doors. Okay? And that means also that they are masters of the first exceptional training in ethics. And the next one is shiwa. Okay? I'll go through the list a bit faster now. Okay? The next one is shiwa. Okay? Durwa, shiwa. Shiwa means pacified. And pacified is because they're naturally mindful, that is, they're always mindful, always looking at, always mindful of their behavior, that naturally makes their mind attentive, focus. And that makes it easier for them to control their mind. It makes them easier for them to practice the practice called exceptional training in concentration, in meditation. That's what shiwa means. That's what I mean pacified. And then what's pacified is as you become more and more adept in meditation, slowly, slowly, the mental afflictions are pacified. And meditation is actually is called the worldly way of controlling the mental afflictions. Just by having a habit of going into deep meditation, naturally pacifies the mental afflictions. Okay. And that's why the pacified has to do. Okay. And the next one is Nirshiva. And Nirshiva means very pacified. Okay. And what's very pacified? The mental afflictions. And how do you very pacify the mental afflictions? And meditation itself pacify the mental afflictions to a certain degree, but to have a real impact on the mental afflictions, you need wisdom. Okay, so that means they have a very good practice, in the exceptional practice of exceptional training in wisdom. Now, this one doesn't mean that they've had a direct perception of emptiness already, a direct perception of the true nature of reality. It just means that they are so trained in that view, in the correct view, and their mind is so used to it that they're not fighting with it, at least on an intellectual level. Okay. So Nyawa, Shiva, Nirshiva. And this has to do with the three exceptional training in ethics, exceptional training in meditation or concentration, and exceptional training in wisdom. Okay. And then comes some of the other trainings, qualifications. It's the next one is Yuanten Lakpa. So the person that you're going to as a teacher, who's going to teach you, must have qualities which exceed yours. Now, it doesn't mean that overall that this person must exceed you in everything. He must be a better basketball player than you. Okay. They must sing better than you. It doesn't mean that. But the particular subject that they are going to teach you, the reason that you're going to them for them to teach you is because they excel you in that subject. And an example of it is between Jason Kawa and his teacher, Rendawa. In one particular subject, Rendawa excelled Jason Kapa, but in other subjects, Jason Kapa excelled Rendawa, Jason Kapa's teacher. Okay? It could be something like that. And that's when you hear such terms as scripture teacher, and you start to hear lama of specific subjects. Oh, this is my logic lama. This is my lama on scripture. This is my lama on such and such a subject. Because that particular teacher excel you, at least in knowledge, in that particular field of subject. And that's the next one. So, Duruwa, Shiwa, Nyeshiwa, Yuanten Lakpa, Suanche. Suanche means, and this one has to do with effort. It's somewhat connected with another of the qualifications. In the Vinaya, a good practitioner is someone who doesn't sleep. They don't sleep during the first night, part of the night, and the last part of the night. And that was something that was confusing to me for a long time. That means I'm supposed to sleep only for 2 hours? No, they consider the night begins at sunset. Whew. Okay? And the night ends at sunrise. Okay? So a few hours right after sunset, you don't sleep. If you sleep during that time, you're considered to be lazy. Okay? And you can understand that. Right before a sunrise, you're not supposed to sleep also. Okay? You're supposed to wake up before sunrise. Okay? And that's what it means, okay? You're supposed to get a good night rest. Okay. So someone who's observing that and during those times, they're practicing. They're studying, or they're practicing, or they're meditating. So that one's someone who has effort. Okay? And also, it has to do with having achieved quiescence. Is that what? Quiescence. Kamabaidi. Shamatha. They have now achieved a great deal of depth in the ability to control their mind. And they have achieved at least shamatha. Okay? And There are many degrees of meditations that someone can achieve and that can aspire to. And when you go back to the very beginning, long time ago, when the golden ages, even maybe about 500 years even after the Buddha, it was very easy to achieve shamatha. Shamatha was like the least achievement in meditation, what we call shine. Okay, that was the least achievement. Actually, as a matter of fact, it wasn't called an achievement. It was called, now you're ready to achieve. You have achieved the state of ready to achieve. Okay. Now you can even achieve the state of ready to be achieved. Okay. And that's because of the degeneration of time. Okay. At the time of that time, the disciples were exceptional, and achieving like what is called the formless meditations was considered to be something to aspire to. Okay. The form meditations, the first, the second, the third, and the fourth, that's all they have, just numbers, were considered to be, you know, average, you know, it's like in a high school, college kind of thing. But PhD was formless meditation. Really exceptional meditation, showing that you really have a refined, your mind is truly under your control, was achieving that, it's not even in the number, but you might call it the ninth level, which is, I forgot the name of it, but it's called tasting nirvana meditation. Where, you know, the reason for doing the meditation is to subdue the afflictions. And as you subdue the afflictions, your mind becomes more peaceful and you experience a greater sense of euphoria or bliss. And that's because of the pacification of the mental afflictions. But when you come out of it, or even still, there is still the affliction of ignorance, right? That you haven't completely removed yet. And there's still some more subtle afflictions, so the bliss is not really quite the kind of bliss you want. So if you want to, as a means of encouraging disciples, strengthening their faith that there is actual nirvana, so they would do this meditation where they would enter into a taste of nirvana and where they would experience such bliss that if they didn't make preparations to awaken from it, that they would probably get lost in it for some very long time, like some weeks or months or even some years, okay, because of the overwhelming power of that bliss. So nowadays, we cannot expect one of the qualifications of the teacher is to, okay, test nirvana right now, okay, then I'll follow you. At least one of the signs is at least shine, which is called access meditation. Okay. And that's what the Sun Che is about. Okay. And the next one is, I forgot the number, Makeden. Makeden. And Makeden has to do with being an exceptional at teaching. Being an exceptional at knowing what to teach, when is the proper time to teach this, when is the proper time to teach that, what disciples need this, what disciples need that. So that a master at teaching. Okay, Makeden means possessing masters, possessing skill in speaking, in ma, in speaking. And this ma refers to, speaking refers to teaching. If the person that you're going to, that you have some faith in, you cannot determine anything about them in terms of these qualifications. This one, I have to say, because I forgot what number it is. It's number 9, but for me it's number 1. Okay. Sewa Dagni. Dagni means the embodiment. Sewa is love. It's the embodiment of love. If this person, in their behavior, not when you're around, they behave like they love you, or they have love, but when you catch them unawares, when you meet them in the street or something like that, you still see from them that they're for you, they seem to be the embodiment of love. And it is said that if the one that you've taken on as a lama, even if he lacks the other quality, he's not really rich in scripture, that's one of the qualities. I don't know which number it is, probably the one that I'm forgetting. Number 6, that's Lungichuk, okay? Rich in scripture. That is what it means, exactly what it says, rich in scripture. Okay. They've studied a lot and they have a bunch of scriptures under their belt. Okay. So even if they don't know that many scripture, their mind, as far as concentration is concerned, they don't have that much powerful concentration. At least, well not at least, but number 1 qualification, if they have that, then you can take them as a teacher. If they seem to you the embodiment of love, okay, then everything else doesn't really matter. Because that itself is the best teacher. Another qualification, I forgot the number, is that I think it's the last one. Kyo wa pang. Kyo wa pang. Okay? That means kyoa means someone. It's like laziness. It's like being tired. Okay. It's like this person doesn't give up on you. It's a mark of their compassion. Okay. They don't give up on you. And nothing else need to say about that one. And there's one qualification I think I'm missing. I think I've given you 9.
Talk.
Oh yeah. Then you have to talk.
Yeah.
Then you have to talk. That's one I forgot. I forgot because well, never mind. I'll explain it, then you will listen. Then you have to talk has to do with understanding of wisdom. And it's almost like the third qualification. This one means that their understanding of wisdom is very rich. It's like their intellectual understanding of emptiness is extremely profound. And when they say the intellectual understanding of emptiness is profound, that itself is a huge realization. It's not just, that they read a book and they understand it. They heard about emptiness, or they read about it, they meditate upon it, and then they gain a profound understanding of it. It is understood in certain circles that when Jason Kapa did his retreat and he had this profound understanding of Uma, of Madhyamika, and they said, among the circles, they said that wasn't the direct perception of emptiness that he had. What he had was a profound intellectual understanding of emptiness. Like the very last intellect understanding of the limit of what your intellect can grasp of emptiness. And to achieve that requires, tremendous effort. It's almost as if you're almost directly perceiving emptiness. Okay. That's what they're referring to here. Someone who has deep, profound understanding of emptiness or direct perception of emptiness, notwithstanding. Okay. I think I've mentioned, that's 10? Okay, that's 10, right? All right. Okay, good, I have some time. Now let's go into Lama, okay? You've heard the term Tsawe Lama. That means root Lama. And the reason that you say root Lama is because, just like a tree depends on its roots, the trunk depends on the root, and because the trunk depends on the root, it can bear flower, it can bear fruit. So the person who's going to flower, make you flower into a Buddha one day, or who's going to make you have all those deep, beautiful qualities that you yourself are going to have within yourself, the Makedan, Sewedatni, all those qualities that the Lama has, supposed to have, that person that you're depending on for that, that you're relying on for that, that's your Tsawe Lama. Now, the term Tsawe Lama has a very romantic thing connected with it. Most of the time, the Tsawe Lama is not somebody that you examine for a long time. Okay? It's someone that once you meet them, you already feel a connection. Okay? And then for you to not be fooled by just mere emotions, firing, synapses, you don't want to mistake that for some truly finding your Tsawe Lama, then you examine. Okay? But usually the Tsawe Lama is somebody that you have this deep, immediate connection with. You can meet someone that people say is very high lama, very enlightened, and has a lot of realizations, and you feel nothing for them. You feel no connection. And you might think, what's the matter with me? And this is supposed to be, so-and-so, the 5,000th reincarnation of Buddha, whatever, from Pure Land, from the East, the Yellow Bunny, something like that. Yellow Bunny of Paradise. And here I am in his presence, and everybody keep telling me that's him, and I feel nothing for him. Something is wrong with me. I should be, taking that person as my Tsawe Lama. Or you hear so-and-so is, some people have met Kemin Boshe and they feel nothing for him. And they hear that, that's number one Larampa of, when he graduated. Not only is he a Larampa Geshe, he's number one Larampa. That means for that year, all the Larampas got together, they were tested, and he was the number one amongst them. He came out top. And not only that, he went to Gyume Tantra College, he almost became the abbot. So you hear all these qualifications, he's qualified, as far as riches, scripture is concerned. But you feel no connection. So you think, wait a minute, something is wrong with me, I have bad karma. Well, it's not necessarily the case. Some people even go meet His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, who has millions of disciples, and they don't feel anything for him. It's not like they feel disrespect for him, but that connection, immediate connection, they don't feel it. An example of this, Ken Rinpoche is, never mind, not that one. And I used another one, very recent. Gyume Kenso Rinpoche. Well, there's a bunch of Gyume Kenso Rinpoches because there were many abbots of Gyume. The particular one that actually made connection with us. He taught at Three Jewels recently and at Diamond Mountain a few times, and that one, okay? That's Gyume Kenso Rinpoche. Gyume Kenso Rinpoche, okay? I mean, just his title alone should make you so, oh! Right? He was the abbot of a tantric monastery. What qualifies you to become the abbot of a tantric monastery is that you have become master of ceremony. That is, you can do what someone can just, they put a bunch of ceremonies in a hat and pull up one and say, okay, can you do this one? And you start doing it, okay? A true master of ceremony. So you have to be that so you can become qualified to become an abbot of Gyume or Gyute. Okay, so there's this lama, who seems to be a Tsewe Dagni. He seems to be Tsewe Dagni. For me, that's the normal qualification. Okay, that's what I look for. If you're Tsewe Dagni, if I can find, I don't care if you have 20,000 PhDs and everyone calls you Lalampa, you are Lalampa one in, I don't know, 10 consecutive years or something. There's no such thing, okay? But if in case you're such thing, for me, I'm still looking for where's Tsewe Dagni? Where's Tsewe Dagni? Until I see Tsewe Dagni, I'm not going to be impressed. So he seems to be Tsewe Dagni, and he has all these other qualifications as far as scripture is concerned. I mean, tantric abbot. At least he must have at least some measure of meditation, right? He must have meditated at least once. Okay. Even if he was forced to meditate, at least that counts. Okay. Okay. Before you become an avid, you must at least meditate for now. Okay. So that's in there also. But I have to say, I love him, but I don't feel that immediate teacher connection with him. That doesn't mean that I would not take teachings from him. I would be crazy not to take teachings from him. But what they call Tsawe Lama, I don't feel that for him. And I would, if he says, come, I'll teach you, I'll drop everything and be his student. Okay. Now here's part of the story. His student is Gyuto Rinpoche. His student was the abbot of the other tantric monastery. That tells you the caliber of this teacher. Okay. He's meeting Gyuto Rinpoche's. Okay. And the same qualification for Gyume Rinpoche is for Gyuto Rinpoche's also. It's just the other tantric monastery. The difference between Gyume and Gyute is in this. This is Gyume. I won't be able to do it because I've been talking for so long. That was Gyute. He was Gyume. That's basically the difference between the two. Okay? And Gyume is much more difficult to do than Gyute. So here I am, I go to meet with, I hear that Gyume Kenso Rinpoche is in town, so take me to him. So I got my katak and my little offering, and I go to his room, and I'm prostrating. And then as I'm prostrating to him, and there's Gyuto Rinpoche to his right. And then as soon as I see him, first time I'm seeing him, I feel that connection. And I'm feeling that I should be proceeding to Gyuto Rinpoche. And of course, I don't do it, of course, because teacher, student, I'm proceeding to the, I got to do this. And it's not only just for me that I feel this immediate contact with him. And as I look into his eyes, I see that he feels that for me also, like saying, come, my son. You want to cry? In Kishore. Okay. And I keep going in there, I sit closer to Gyuto Rinpoche, and then he grabs my hand. Yes. The Tibetans love doing that, especially if they feel connected with you. They grab my hand, as I'm just talking to Gyume Kenso Rinpoche, and he's, connecting with me. And I grab his hands back. And it's like, when you meet your Tsawe Lama, the only way I can express is that it's like you fall in love. And as a matter of fact, you might even confuse that emotion of falling in love with finding the Tsawe Lama. You might think that, wait a minute, something's wrong with you. Why am I having this worldly feeling for this holy being? Okay, it's just we don't have the proper context to express it or to explain it. So we say falling in love. Okay. I say it's like you're falling in love. You fell in love. And every single emotion of connection that you can think of, you feel it. It's like all of a sudden you feel like in the presence of your father, you feel you're in the presence of your mother, you feel like you're in the presence of your best friend, you feel like in the presence of your lover, all rolled up in one being. And to bring it back to the very beginning of the Tawi Lama is the Buddha. When the Guru is God, that kind of an aphorism. Okay. What does it mean? It's none of your business if in his mind he thinks he's Buddha. Or he realized that Buddhahood. It's none of your business. But because of your karmic relationship with him, because of your connection, because of your whatever you have established with him, with that person, with her or him, he becomes for you the focus, the focal point where all the Buddhas meet. And if you relate with him in a proper way, it's like you're respecting, you're showing respect to that connection that you feel. And by showing respect to that connection, all the Buddhas come. And in his own mind, he's probably playing around, saying silly things, and you're hearing Dharma. So Tawi Lama covers a bunch of things. It covers something that deals with just the mystical. It covers very practical. It covers things that goes beyond what we can think of. It is all these things. It is not just one of those things. At the very moment, any being, when you achieve Buddhahood, at that very moment, your job begins. Your career begins as a Buddha. And what is that? To make others into Buddhas. And you don't sit in your paradise waiting for someone to, you know, to pay you the proper respect so you can begin. Whoever is a living being, whoever is a sentient being, you go to them. And whether they are asking you for Buddhahood or not, you're giving them Buddhahood. So if one Buddha is doing it, that means all the other Buddhas are doing it. All the Buddhas, all those weakened Buddhas in the past, as soon as they became Buddhas, they did it. They connected with each and every single sentient being. They stuffed your mind with Buddhahood. Those who are becoming Buddhas right now, they're doing it at this very moment. And those who will be doing it in the future, they will continue to do it. So for you, where do all these Buddhahoods, where are they meeting? Where's the point? That point is the Tawi Lama. That's why they say the Tawi Lama is more important than all the Buddhas. That's because he is all the Buddhas and more. And when you get into more mystical things, if that wasn't mystical enough, they say the Tawi Lama is your own Buddha nature. Your own Buddha nature is the Tawi Lama. Now, does that mean that, wait a minute, that means he's no longer the point where all the Buddhas meet? Or does it mean that he's no longer that person that I'm having this very close connection with? She encompasses all that. Yes, it is your Buddha nature. Yes, it is that point that you've encountered that you're calling Mr. or Miss so-and-so. Yes, it is all the Buddhas. If you think that's not mystical enough, one more mystical to add to the mystery. Okay. And this is, it's going to be very difficult to take because it may sound like something that I tried to refute earlier. The Tawi Lama is your future Buddhahood. So if you're lucky and you meet someone that you feel this connection with, that person becomes that point for all these elements. You're looking at your own Buddha nature, you're looking at your own Buddhahood, and then you're looking at every single Buddha that exists. So to really round it up, Jesokapa is Lama. Why is he Lama? Because he is the point where all the Buddha's compassion meet. He's the point where all the Buddha's wisdom meet. He's the point where all the Buddha's power meet for your sake. Okay. And you have to put for your sake in there. It's a very personal. And it is a personal affair. You're not assigned a Tawi Lama. You don't go to some course or to some teacher who said, okay, now this is your Tawi Lama and this is your Tawi Lama. You say, I don't like that guy. He said, I don't care. It's your Tawi Lama. It's not that way. And the Tawi Lama is not going to behave in front of you always perfectly. That is, you're not going to perceive the Tawi Lama behaving perfectly all the time. You will see faults sometimes. As a matter of fact, at a distance, the Tawi Lama is extremely beautiful. And that's one of the qualifications mentioned in the Sutra and the Tantra. That's not listening here. And you understand what that means, right? They say one of the qualifications for a teacher is that he must be beautiful. And that doesn't mean that, you know, he must be someone who signed with Cosmo magazine or something as a model. It means that when you see him, no, the definition of beauty, what brings pleasure to your mind. So when you see the being, it brings pleasure to your mind. That means for you, it's beautiful. Okay, that's what the Buddha means. Doesn't mean that if he's too short or too tall, don't take him as a lama. If he walks awkward, if he doesn't sound right, don't take him, okay? It means that. I need to say something now about something that His Holiness has mentioned earlier. Okay, it was because once you've established a relationship of Tawi Lama with someone, they're supposed to be your guard, right? Whatever they say is law. So if they tell you, do something that you already believe to be something that you shouldn't be doing, what should you do? That's your Tawi Lama. If you disobey, you go to hell. So it says in the book. I'll read it for you. So what do you do when your Tawi Lama is doing something which is evidently, to your eyes, something that should not be done? Should you sever your relationship? You're no longer my Tawi Lama. I fire you. You can examine it in a very psychological way. I want Buddhahood. Okay, you're going to give me Buddhahood. And the reason that you can give me Buddhahood is because you're the point where all the Buddhas meet from. And I observe you. And I don't like what I see. So now I fire you. Connected with that, what are you firing?
All the parts.
Yeah, all that. But this is a very difficult thing, especially when a lot of Tawi Lamas exhibit behaviors that they just cannot live with, they just cannot deal with. Remember, it's not the Lama's behavior necessarily which is your teacher. And it is your teacher. It's not the literal words of the Lama that's your teacher. And you don't have to go into mental gymnastics to get yourself out of it or to make yourself not go crazy. If your Lama tells you to do something and you know it's wrong, what do? You say, I cannot do it. And your relationship is still intact. You're not firing all the Buddhas. You're not firing your Buddhahood. Because you cannot do it. That's what it means. That's what it means to you, right? It's difficult for you to do. So you just be honest. It's difficult. I cannot do it. If your Lama say, go kill this person, I would ask you to ask, please teach me how to kill. And keep connecting it, okay? Buddhahood, the compassion of all the Buddhas, the power of all the Buddhas, the wisdom of all the Buddhas, wants to teach me something. So, and now it's because of my karmic imprints, I'm hearing, go kill so-and-so. From the appearance of it, Padmasambhava killed a few people, from the appearance of it. But what did he really do? So if you're lucky, I mean, you should be very lucky, if you establish a connection with someone that you've examined properly, and they seem to have all the qualifications, especially the Tsewedakni, and he tells you, go kill so-and-so, then the immediate reaction should be, please teach me. You think you already know how to kill. You have no idea how to kill. And if you cannot make yourself immediately say that, then you have to say what's really in your mind. I cannot do it. Don't think that saying I cannot do it is disobeying your Lama. That's not disobeying your Lama. And this clarification came from His Holiness, because there's a practice that his Lama told him to do that he could not do any longer, and he stopped. But he still weeps when he speaks of his Lama, of this particular Lama. He hasn't severed the relationship of Lama, but this practice he cannot do, and he doesn't do it. Finding a Tawi Lama doesn't mean now you found your, how do you say that? Doesn't mean that you should completely abandon your intelligence. Doesn't mean that you should completely abandon your discrimination. And if the Tawi Lama is very skillful, they will test your discrimination to see what, if you're going to be responding properly. If they tell you to go kill someone, it's to say if you actually are crazy enough to go kill someone. And if they tell you to do something that you know is wrong, you just say, I cannot do it. Don't say, that's wrong. Don't ask me to do something like that. You don't respond that way. Okay. So as you know, you can't do it. The question was just that, and I hope I covered as much as I could on the Lama thing. And this is a very sensitive topic for a lot of people. If you have questions, maybe next class. But if you have some questions about Lama, Tawi Lama, then we can ask it next time. His Holiness Dalai Lama's, what I remember, what he said about that relationship. Okay. So that will be your answer, your weapon, my weapon. Your intellect will fight with the idea. Why should I consider him a Buddha? Why did I just take him for what he is or what she is? Just a nice guy who happens to know more than I do. It's not going to help your practice. It is an expedient means to help you fly in your practice. Even if it's made up, it's an expedient made up means to help you fly in your practice. I just said it to Drum Drumpa, I think. The reason that you Tibetans are not having realizations is because you think your teachers are just another guy just like you. So, what can another guy just like you help you get to be another guy just like you? Yeah.